accession number.
Of Fred Laurie 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Duisburg, West Germany, on March the 28th, 1924.
What does Fretlaw mean?
Well, Fretlaw, or Fretleur to be precise, it's a Huguenot name. And as far as I remember, or as far as we can go back to 1725, I believe. And the name had changed then to Lohé. Well, as what we were being told is that this is a Huguenot name, and it came from Francis of Protestants, are Huguenots, and they were persecuted, and they fled most likely across the River Rhine and settled towards the middle Germany there. And that's where my family came from, my father's side of the family.
The O should have an umlaut.
Oh. Yes, the O, it's O with an umlaut. It's O-E, or Leur, which I have since I lived in England. My telephone number, or let's say in the directory, it's not Leur, because there's not many people in England can pronounce Leur, you see. So I made it easier, same as my ancestor did when they went into Germany. God knows what they were called prior to Fred Leur. As I said, there's one syllable there, which is that Lohé. Now, they might have made it easier for the people who live there to understand the name. And I did exactly the same. In the phone book, you will find it's Fred Law. Quite a lot of people. There's a lot of people called Law. It's L-O-W. It's a lot easier to pronounce for an English person, Fred Law, than what it is Fred Lur. You see, and that's why everybody calls me Fred Law. But Fred Law.
And what about your mother's side of the family?
My mother's side of the family, they came from Westphalia, and they've got a proper German name, which is Baumann. Baumann means, I suppose in the old days, he was a builder or something like that. And my mother came from Witten Annen, actually, and it's in Westphalia. And, that's where she was born. She was grown up in Duisburg, actually, because her mother died at the birth, when she was born, and it was her father and her mother now, this is part of a joke, they were twins. So my auntie, or her mother in fact, future mother, said she's not going to stay there because there were five or six children already. So we'll take her. And she was brought up in Duisburg as well. And then that was, to her, it was her mother, but actually it was her auntie. Well, you couldn't get it much closer, because her father and her auntie were twins. See, that the most closest relation you can imagine. And to me, that was my grandma. I didn't know her in any other way but my grandma, you see. But matter of fact, it was an auntie.
And what did your father do for a living?
Well, my father, he was born in Duisburg as well, obviously. And he was a manager in the telephone section from Thyssen, the steel company, or Frederick Thyssen in Duisburg. And he led all the telephone sections and God knows what. And he had one or two inventions on telephones and things like that. But I've always known, or since I was born, I never knew a household without a telephone.
What do you remember about your schooling? Was that in Duisburg?
That was in Duisburg as well. Well, Duisburg is a very, very, very big town, same as Leeds or London. And you've got suburbs like we had in Duisburg. You've got Hamborn, you've got Meidrick, you've got Beek, and you've got Ruhrort, and one or two others. And he was born in Meidrick, so was I. I was born in Duisburg, Meidrick, which is part of Duisburg. And they always lived there all their lives, because in those days, Well, if you had a day's outing, well, what was it, about 20 miles by tram or somewhere like that? And you never used to go away like they do now, abroad or anything like that.
What do you remember about your schooling?
My schooling? Just like anybody else's. I went to a school, got the education like every child had. My father and my mother were an ex-teacher. They wanted me to go to the grammar school. But Robert didn't like the grammar school because I went in and there were all these languages and they tested it. And looking at me now, he said, I'm in English and I remember that. And I begged and begged while I said, right, we take you out. And I'm more mechanically minded and as a tradesman. Well, my brother went to the school there and he was educated as a grammar school boy. But unfortunately, that the last, or let's say the end of the war, they got all these young kids, they got him into the army. And unfortunately, he got killed on the 26th of April, 1945 at Rendsburg. There's the canal which connects the Baltic Sea and the North Sea, and there's a bridge on which is called Kaiser Wilhelm Bridge, and it's like a loop to approach it to go over it, and there's a loop at the other side to go down. And as far as we got to know is that they were waiting in the evening on the bottom of the loop, and they were going to set off very early in the morning to get over the thing. And which they did, and as soon as they approached the runner, fighter bombers came and strafed the trains. Well, of course, the fighter bomber didn't know that about all young kids in there, you see. He was 17. He died on the 26th of April, that's a week before the war finished, and a month before his 18th birthday.
Was this grammar school that you started called Steinbach Gymnasium?
No. It was the Baker Mittelschule. Mittelschule is grammar school. You see, well, it's not like England where you, my daughter, when she went to Morley Grammar School, you do the ordinary education, then you go to the advanced, what they call it, A levels, and then you go to university. But in Germany, you used to go to Mittelschule, Gymnasium, and then to the university. Well, my brother, well, of course, it was just wartime, and he would. Just went through the grammar school, but then of course he got killed, you see. He didn't get any further then, I'm afraid, you see. No.
How old were you when you left school then?
In those days, you leave school when you're 15. Or was it 14 or 15? 1938. Or 14. 14, that's it. And then applied for trades as an electrician. You got to go through a test with Thyssen before you get selected to be in an apprentice with Thyssen. And I was 14 in 1938 when I started my apprenticeship. And I served my time there as an electrician.
This is in the steelworks in Duisburg?
Yes, very much so. The old big steel industry, very much. Electro-melting stoves, iron ore, rolling mills, you name it. But Thyssen is world known. Thyssen had their biggest private railway net in Europe. They also had a harbour, which is a well-known inland harbour, a lot to do with it. That was Ruhr, the biggest inland harbour in Europe. We're all fed by the River Rhine. You see, where all the barges came with the iron ore and things like that.
Were they a good employer in 1938?
Yes, I must say that, because Thyssen had a policy, I suppose it were here, from the cradle to the grave. You see, when my father was there as an apprentice, he was there 50 years, something like that. But anyway, when he retired, when they retired him, eventually when after 65, 66, whatever he were. But you have your own hospitals, or let's say own insurance people. You've got your own technical school, which I attended. You had to go to the technical school because it was just like going to work, because you had to clock in. You could not miss anything whatsoever. It was one full day, and the other day, there were 2 days actually, one full day, the other day were Morning was sport, you used to do swimming or gymnastics or what, and the afternoon were college again, and then one full day. And you had to attend that all the time you were an apprentice. And when all those things go in the evening like they did here, and if they didn't like it, I didn't go. You could do that whatsoever. You had to attend the technical college, as simple as that, because it was all part of your education as an electrician. And it, in your book or qualification papers and what you have, it gives you the attendance in the college and whatever. You see, you couldn't fake anything at all. You were an apprentice, you were really qualified as an electrician.
And what was your address pre-war?
It was Duisburg. Well, my proper address there then was Duisburg, Hamborn. Duisburg, Hamborn is... Hamborn is part of Duisburg. And my father was not allowed to live further away than 5 minutes' walk from his office or from the department of telephones, because anything happens, you see, he can walk. There were no those days, and in them days, there were no cars or very, very few. And eventually they issued him or with a motorbike and sidecar, which I've got photographs of, and so that he can go from there to another part of the factory on another part. You see, they were so large, what, Tyson. You see, if he would have done it on the bike, it would have taken a day to do this. You see, they would have had a motorbike. And he used to do that with sidecar.
You mean his employer required him to live nearby?
Yes, that was part of the policy. And I always remember that when he always started at 7 o'clock in the morning, not like managers do here, 9 or 10 o'clock. 7 o'clock at morning, while 1, and then he had off while 3, and then while 6, I believe, in the evening. They had a very, very long working life, you know, as far as that goes. But obviously, he had his perks with it. There's this telephone in the house. The flat where we lived in were always central heating. I've never ever known a household where we lived in, or we did when I was a baby, that there was no central heating or no telephone. It's just, this is part of my life, upbringing, central heating, telephone, and all the mod cons, you see.
So, what kind of a life was your family living pre-war?
Very, very strict. My father was pretty strict, and our family circuit, my mother's side and my father's side, especially my mother's side, because father's side, the boys spread across in Germany, see, so you never really got in touch as much what we did with mother's side. And there, the old saying or the old thing were, children are to be seen, not to be heard. When they used to have parties or anything like that, we were not allowed in the same room. We used to go in the kitchen, and Grandma used to be there and making us some, what do you want, some chips and fried egg and chocolate pudding with vanilla. And we used to, well, what does lads and, well, we had only one girl among the relation. There were four, my brother and two cousins or three cousins. And the mother's side, we had girls among them. But we used to get our meal what Grandma made, and then we used to go out and play. We didn't want to sit with the old people, because we weren't allowed to interrupt them. They were there, and that's as simple as this. And another thing which we always had to do, we are still doing it now, this is something, it's like a religion in our family circuit. If you go and visit somebody, you always take a bunch of flowers. And if there's children there, you always take some chocolates or sweets. And that is still a policy we... I don't know if the children do it. No, I don't think they do. But the way I was brought up, it were pretty strict. And you had a very, very respect for the elders, especially your grandparents and grandmas and grandpas. You had a heck of a respect for them. You always had to do.
So what was your standard of living like pre-war?
Very good. With father being the manager. I mean, he earned quite well. So our standard of living was very, very good.
Did you personally have any military training pre-war?
No, in that respect. What actually happened is, like all the boys did, well, I were very, very interested in making glider models. And then we joined, before the war, prior to the war, we joined the Hitler Youth for the simple reason they used to have gliding clubs. Well, you couldn't, there were no private glidings. You see, so you joined them, you used to go at weekends, not every weekend, ever so often. You used to go there again, they were about 10, 15 miles away from Duisburg, into the countryside. There were a big hill, and that's where I learned how to glide. And I eventually finished up with a B, this chart of the C, which is the C when you start doing solo flights on the proper gliders. And I used to love anything. I mean, as a young boy, that was part of my life, doing aeroplanes, gliding, things like that, messing about with gliders and flying. You can call it pre-education for military service, whichever people want to call it. It's all part of my upbringing. But the same thing applies in this country.
Did you ever have any accidents pre-war?
Not really.
With the gliders?
No. Definitely not, no.
Did you think that a war was coming at that time?
No. We were too young to think about that. You see, I mean, when the war broke out, I was just about 15. And it was, no. It was because when the war broke out, there was such a lot of troops in our area because where we lived, it was near the Dutch border. You see, and little boys or little lads, myself, soldiers and horses and all. It was something, you know, the soldiers used to be billeted in our flats upstairs in the loft. There were some rooms there, and they had, I think we had about three or four soldiers in there. And we always, as little boys, we used to be fascinated with these lads. You know, like children are. A soldier is always an attraction. And it applied there, that's the same it does in this country, you see.
So when war broke out in September 39, how did you feel about it?
I can't remember that really. But the war, we were told by my parents, oh, you won't be a soldier. It'll be all over at Christmas. We don't, the normal, or let's say the ordinary people had no desire to start a war there. It was the political side really, you see. They got away with it. Let's put it this way. The long and short of it all is, I heard my parents talk about it. After the First World War, Duisburg, or the part where they lived in, the French occupied that one. And it wasn't a very pleasant time for the Germans who lived there. The Germans were not allowed to walk on the footpath. They had to walk in between the tram lines. And there was the inflation, where my mother and my father used to tell me, when father used to work, he used to run to the gate and give mother some money at lunchtime to buy some food. Now, in the evening, he got paid again, and that money for lunchtime would have bought him a box of matches in the evening. You see, that's how the inflation worked. And then, eventually, along came a bloke like Hitler, and said, we'll give you work, we'll give you this, we'll give you that, we'll give you other. Well, he actually did do that, because what does a working man want? He wants a roof over his head, he wants some food, he wants a pint of beer, and he wants a smoke. And it was there, they had work, plenty of work. But when they realised what was actually happening, it was too late. See, anybody who was opened their mouth or were against it, they were just arrested, you see, and what happened to them? Well, we found out afterwards. Well, we didn't know as children. The elder people didn't know neither. You see, they were arrested for anti-so-and-so, anti-so-and-so. This is, of course, the dictatorship type of getting people, which still is the same in Russia now, or in any communist country. Or communism and nationalism, it's exactly the same, just in reversed order, you see. I mean, the communists say, what's yours is mine, and what's mine has nothing to do with you. And that's a communist idea. And I suppose that means for the Germans as well. Because I cannot complain. I mean, we had plenty of food. I've had plenty of everything as far as that goes. I could go, I joined a canoe club on the River Rhine. I had a canoe which my father bought me, and we were messing around on the river, and we were doing this, and we were camping on the other side of the river for the weekend, and like lads do, and I used to go gliding. Where else could you go gliding? You got cadets today, Air Force cadets, they're gliding. Well, there are, my son-in-law, he's a flight lieutenant with the RAF cadets. And they go out, he's just been out to a place in Wales with the cadets. Well, what are they? They're getting military trained. It's just a different name. Air Force cadets, Navy cadets, Army cadets, it's just a different name. Over there they're called a Hitler Youth.
So once the war broke out, were you personally affected by the war at first?
Yes. Actually, straight away. Because the odd thing were, the war, I'm convinced it was Sunday morning, whatever, when the war declared. And we had the first siren going on the same day. And shortly after, the first bombs fell in the area where I lived. And the first bomb which fell next to the Catholic Church into the vicarage or hall, that was the first bomb I've ever experienced there. And then it's got more and more and more, and the casualties were straight away were quite high. And I still remember that we had two blocks further to us, there's a bomb went into the back cellar, and I don't know how many, 10 or 12 people got killed in that cellar. And I think there's one little baby were alive. We got it out. I was still a lad then, because all the cellars, every flat used to have cellars, and that was done, the walls between each house only had a thin brick wall, so in case anything happens, you could break through and go from one to the other, which we did. And one of the, I think it was a girl, it was her little baby sister, and she died, or she got killed, and her head were cradled under her. She crouched, and the baby sit were between her legs and her stomach, you see, and that's how the baby survived. And all the rest of the people were just squashed into the cone and killed.
Do you remember what the address of that place would be, or the street?
The street was called Kaiser Wilhelm Street, and it was one of the main streets, which Kaiser Wilhelm Street. And on the other side were some more workmen's houses, and then behind there were the factories. But the odd thing were, which I always found amazing, that the factory was not bombed right at the beginning of the war. Nowhere near it. It was not bombed while more or less the end of the war. And another thing were, outside Duisburg, there were, in the countryside, there were IG Farben, it's like ICI. And this was a factory, underground factory, and a factory which made ammunition, gunpowder, explosive and all that. There wasn't a leaflet dropped near there, never mind a bomb, because it was an international concern. You see, you think about that afterwards, and he said, why the heck haven't they done that? Well, why did they bomb the civilians first? To get the morality down, that was the reason. The factory, they did do eventually, this went over one night and they just flattened the factories completely. But to get the people first, that was the aim.
Do you remember any leaflet dropping?
Oh yeah. There were all sorts of leaflets being dropped, and I don't remember the contents of those leaflets, but they used to drop leaflets, definitely.
Did you read the leaflets?
No, I can't remember. I think we were too young, and we must have read them, but we younger, or let's say boys at 14, 15, you don't understand the whole meaning of a leaflet. Well, the way it were worded, let's put it that way, you know.
Were the leaflets taken seriously or left out?
I wouldn't like to say. I don't know what the elder people did. They just, as far as my parents were concerned, I think they just threw it away. And propaganda, you see, and that's, I think that were the main answer to the, that's propaganda, you see, and as simple as that.
Now, can you tell me about how you came to join the army, please?
Well, like everybody else, when I were, that's another little, tiny little story was, I had to go for my medical. I was just before my 18th birthday. I went to the medical, and I wasn't a small little boy then. I was pretty well built then, and you go through the medical, of course, you're absolutely naked. You go through and they'll assess you, and I remember one of the doctors, whoever you were, excuse me, saying saying to me, heavy artillery. And I said, sorry sir, I volunteered for the Air Force, which I didn't. Well, of course, and then they said, so they said, right, Air Force. And you get a lapel, or let's say a rosette which said Air Force. You were selected for the Air Force. And I went home straight away with a form and said to Father, I said, I want you to sign this. What is it? I said, well, I volunteered for the Air Force. Oh, he went mad at my father. And so, but he thought, he must have been on the same mind as me. The Air Force is not as bad as the Army. It's more selected people get into the Air Force, which I joined when I was 18. I was 18 in March 1942. I was 18, 1942, and I was called up in April 1942. And I went to Munster in Westphalia. Is it Westphalia? Or Munster, anyway. And I joined the Communications Air Force, which were Morse coding, this and that and other. And eventually I finished up on radar.
How were you treated at first in the Air Force when you were first trained?
Oh, like every other raw recruit, you knew about it when you joined the force. It's like, oh, you had the food like anybody else, but you were in the forces and you were treated like a soldier. And I mean, you were you did square washing like anybody else.
And how did you stand up to the discipline?
No problem. You just did as you're told, and that's as simple as that. And then you got posted. I got posted eventually, and I finished up as a radar mechanic, but not as a radar engineer. Radar mechanic, you service or you look after a radar equipment. And eventually I finished up in Dresden, which were East Germany. And there, at the school in Dresden, we were instructing WAFs and male personnel on the training of or maintaining radar equipment. And there was a period I had to earn some extra money and all this, that and other. I used to go to the office semester when they had parties and all that. I used to be a waiter. Or another thing I used to do, Opera House in Dresden, which were well known all over Germany, and they always wanted lads, or let's say young men, for stooging, you see. And there was another lad who introduced me to that. We used to go there. They used to dress you up in and makeup and all the lot, and you used to be standing at the back of the back of the stage as a soldier with a lance, or you know, the old opera. There were one which were Master Singer of Nuremberg. I took part in that. Carmen were another one. The Flying Dutchman were another one. I think three or four. I can't remember the other ones. And you just were a stooge at the back, you see. You didn't do or say anything at all. You just stood there, or maybe had to walk over there, and that's it. And you used to get 5 marks, which were quite a lot of money, you see. But to come back to the officers' mess,